The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
Welcome to the Korea Society and welcome to Studio Korea. My name is Nikita Desai, Director of Policy and Corporate Programs at the Korea Society. Today's program builds on a continuing series of Korea as Host and Hub. And tonight's discussion is going to take a look at the Green Korea financing and legal aspects of the Green Climate Fund, which is cited in Songdo, Korea. I'm pleased to welcome our two guests today, Granville Martin of JP Morgan Chase. He's the Executive Director of Environmental Affairs, and John Soane, attorney in the Environmental Group of McKenna Long and Aldridge. Granville Martin joined JP Morgan in 2005 to manage environmental risk, develop new business with a nexus to environmental protection, and analyze energy and environmental policy trends that have an impact on JP Morgan clients and businesses. He leads environmental due diligence effort on the oil gas industry with a particular focus on clients engaged in horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. He has worked in the Governor's Pataki's office on environmental issues and represented the Financial Services Forum prior to joining JP Morgan and Chase. John Soane, he's an experienced climate change, energy and natural resources public policy leader. He advises a range of clients on energy, climate change and sustainability matters. His clients include shale gas production companies, renewable energy independent power producers, foreign governments, emerging clean tech companies and financial institutions. Prior to joining McKenna Long and Aldridge, Mr. Soane worked at Climate Change Capital, where he helped develop their global environmental and social risk management policy and advised their investment funds on carbon markets and clean energy policy. He has also worked at the World Resources Institute and International Finance Corporation on environmental and social risk, social risks and opportunities. Please give these two wonderfully expert guest a big round of applause for joining us today. So a year ago at the Korea Society, we hosted Frank Schroeder from the climate change support team at the Office of UN Secretary General, who talked about Korea and the hosting of the Green Climate Fund in Songdo, Korea. So what has changed? How has it really evolved in the last year, if you could talk to us about that?
Sure, Nikita. Well, first of all, thanks to the Korea Society for having me here today. And my colleague Song Jong is on the board of the Korea Society, so I'm sending along good wishes for him and from him as well. And really, the Green Climate Fund's come a long way in a very short period of time. In 2009, in Copenhagen, an international target was set to have $100 billion a year by 2020 of climate finance annually be raised by developed countries to go towards developing countries. And subsequently, through to 2011, the Green Climate Fund was set up under the UN climate negotiations to be one multilateral vehicle to help fulfill that goal. And that money is supposed to be both public and private money towards that goal. And really, in the last year, the Green Climate Fund has really begun to take form. So we see sort of the shell of the fund has come into place. A lot of the business model in terms of the overall outline of it has come into place. We have an executive director. The Songdo is now home to the fund. We have advisory committees set up. Some of the beginnings of a staff is in place. And initial pledging has now been approved under the UN Conference of the Parties process. So a lot of the direction comes from that process, and the board of the fund, which is made up of a variety of members, both from developing and developed countries to the fund, are setting the direction of the fund. So a lot of the structural issues that have to happen for the fund to get towards a real business model and a true capital raising phase of the fund are now in place, and now those two big prongs of capital raising and a business model are set to go in the coming year.
Okay, great. So speaking of capital, I'll turn now to Granville. What does a bank like JP Morgan Chase want to see from GCF? What needs to happen for private sector involvement or engagement?
Sure. Well, let me echo what John said. Thanks for the invitation. And Korea is a very important market to the bank. In fact, Jamie Dimon was just in Korea a month or two ago. He goes every year. The GCF has a lot of promise. Funding pledges are going to be obviously important, and that's going to come from principally national governments. Like other multilateral institutions, private sector entities often participate side by side in either project finance or on a portfolio basis. And what makes that attractive? The GCF is going to need a clear business plan, project selection process that is crisp enough to keep private sector actors interested and focused in participating in a particular transaction, really a private sector focus that institutions like the IFC and some of the multilaterals do a great job of embodying. Those multilateral institutions, when they go to market, they don't have any trouble selling their papers. So obviously, the credit rating of the entity is critically important, whether or not investors are being asked to take project specific risk or portfolio risk is going to be a distinction that matters enormously. It may turn out that it will be easier for investors to get comfortable taking balance sheet risk as opposed to project risk. Project finance, which is something that JP Morgan does not do a lot of, just takes an awful lot of underwriting expertise and manpower. So that by definition will exclude a fair number of financial investors. So I guess the last thing I'd say is sort of the bureaucratic complexity that gets presented or created here is going to matter a lot to the private sector. And, from time to time, some things that the international community creates are pretty complicated.
So bureaucratic complexity when it comes to operating or dealing with multinational entities like the GCF, or it could also be government-led bureaucracy in the individual countries that they're trying to institute projects.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways that kind of complexity can get created. And it doesn't necessarily, come from whatever rules around financial participation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, on that point, there's a board of 24 different countries that the executive director and the staff of the Green Climate Fund have to answer to. And so as they set up a process to do capital raising on the one hand and a business model on the other, and a set of directions from the UN climate change negotiation processes, there's a lot of different agendas on rules around transparency and safeguards and how much of the money should go towards adaptation projects or programs, and how much should go towards mitigation and which countries should be in line first. And there's a whole host of potential issues that go with all that and a lot of people that want their priorities to be met. And so, threading the eye of the needle on that is no small task. and raising capital all the while you're doing all that. So, I mean, I don't envy that task. It's a difficult one. But, you know, doing all that and avoiding bureaucracy is a real challenge. But and then at the end of that, coming out of that and saying, we're going to do transformative projects and not just one solar project here and one wind project here, but really transformative things that are going to mitigate climate change and reduce greenhouse gases at a scale that's really necessary and deliver capital in a way that's really transformative, it's a real big challenge, and the GCF really needs to be a part of that.
So how can a project really be transformative? Are there some examples you can give of, you know, in the past or you know, in terms of public-private engagement or partnerships?
Well, I mean, I would think about it like this. You can put up, what would it take to do a whole suite of electrification of the automotive sector in a given country?
Mm-hmm.
What would it take to make that happen? It's not just about exporting a bunch of electric cars from the United States to a country and saying, go at it, right? It's not just saying, Detroit, send over a bunch of cars. It's about all the infrastructure and all the programs and all the policies and all the training and everything that goes with that to make that happen.
Mm.
And that's a whole lot of expertise and a whole lot of capital, and it's a lot of different types of capital that have to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one example. And so what role can the GCF play in helping to make that happen? And what other private sector capital can they leverage to make that sort of activity happen? I don't know, Granville, do you have any thoughts
on
that?
Every country's, there's not going to be a single paradigm that works in every country. And I think one of the challenges that the GCF has is setting expectations. You know, energy systems and energy policy, they change really slowly. And the GCF and the people who are in the governments that are participating with it, we all need to be realistic about what the time frame is to affect meaningful change. And so with respect to how can the GCF work catalytic change, it needs to pick a particular sector in a particular country and stay there for a while. If you look at the creation of distributed generation markets in the U.S., companies like SolarCity and Sunrun, you know, those guys have recently achieved scale in the last couple of years, but they've been at it for 7 or 8 years, and there are some companies that were trying to do it before them that failed, and now they've picked up the mantle and are exploiting these markets. It takes a while, and I think it is, I know that the GCF, I believe, is supposed to sort of get its administrative house in order over the next year and go out and raise money. And I certainly, you know, applaud their efforts to do that. But they may need more time to get this right. And I think that there ought to be real expectations in 2016 about leaping to judgment about whether or not they've been effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly a lot of challenges ahead. What is the legal, international legal framework that you see with the GCF? And what do you see ahead for the GCF?
Well, I mean, the GCF takes its direction from the UN process and its board. So that's where they operate, and they have the World Bank as a interim trustee as well. So that's sort of the legal framework that within which they operate. And then looking down the line, there's a hope and a goal to have a global climate change agreement in 2015 in Paris. And one would think that part of that agreement would be seeing some real advancements in where the GCF is as part of the overarching goal of developed countries demonstrating that they're advancing the idea of meeting the 2020 targets for $100 billion a year in climate finance. So I think the GCF is a real part of the good faith demonstration of that objective. So they're going to have to, I think they're under some pressure to really show some advancement in their business model and their capital raising efforts. And so it's all the administrative and business model processes that they're going to have to just step-by-step advance to show that progress.
Well, that's great. Are there any final comments that you'd like to add before we turn to Q&A?
Just that, you know, it's like I said, it's going to take a little while. And there's a lot of areas that are separate from putting up a windmill or building a natural gas plant that are obstacles to building mitigation. And it would be terrific if the GCF found a way to participate in bringing down some of those barriers in different countries. If you look at the cost of permitting solar in the U.S., the cost, the soft costs, aside from the panels and the engineering and the installation, they're all over the map. And, you know, compared to what the Germans cost, what transaction costs are in Germany, we're like 10x what it costs in Germany to do that. And I would imagine that there's a lot of those disparities around the world, and how GCF can play a productive role in addressing really boring, esoteric stuff that no one's ever going to get a front page FT article about is really important.
Yeah, I would just say that, I mean, I was in Songdo in early December of last year for the ceremony opening the GCF, and I would just say how impressed I was with the staff that the GCF has in place already, and the new executive director, and how exciting it was for the people of Korea to have this new fund there. And there's a lot of momentum in Songdo, and I think sitting here in in New York, you know, it's hard to feel the tangibility of that, but it really was a big moment in Korea. And so I just think that, you know, it's important for the Korea Society to recognize that.
Well, thank you. I'll now open up to Q&A. I please ask if you identify yourself and your affiliation. We have two mics. Brave one over here.
Hi. I think it's on. Hi, this is Divya at Trucost. I'm a vice president and work with a lot of financial institutions who are looking at environmental risk. And one of the positive stories of the last year has been the massive growth in green bonds investing, with over $1 billion from the IFC that was oversubscribed, and similarly from Bank of America that was also oversubscribed. I was curious if you see a shift in investors being looking at risk differently in climate investments, and if that parallels growth with appetite for investing in the GCF once it finally gets sort of off the ground.
Well, you're quite right. The green bond market, and JP Morgan was one of the four institutions that developed the green bond principles that were announced last week at the UN. The green bond market has grown quite a bit over the last year, and the expectations are it'll grow more in 2014. I mean, what you see is an expansion in investor interest into groups of investors that previously hadn't really expressed a lot of preference for climate investments. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. But green bonds allow investors to have an environmental impact and not give up any of the other market returns or soundness that they get, you know, by buying multilateral paper or perhaps large corporates at an investment grade rating. So we think that's going to continue. Whether the GCF can participate in something like that, if you look at the green bond principles, green bonds are defined, you know, simply as project, you know, bonds that finance projects that are environmentally beneficial. So one would certainly hope that what the GCF is financing would qualify on that basis. The principles impose certain reporting requirements, but I would imagine that the GCF would be would easily meet some of those transparency requirements. So I think there's a good synergy there.
Yeah, I would just add another interesting new player in the green bond market at a significant scale is Zurich, Insurance. That's another interesting company to watch on that. And I think the GCF's role in that is just remains to be seen. It's largely about these business model issues and the flexibility that the GCF is allowed and whether that's the route they choose. But it's certainly something that's probably on the table.
Yes, another question over here.
Tesla, the automobile company, is getting a certain amount of publicity for a prototype that they hope will be transformative and will be a major consumer of certain types of energy and could be transformative in a way. Do they enter your orbit at all, a private company like this?
Go ahead. You know, Tesla is a client of the bank. They have been a really successful company to date. I think just, speaking personally, not for JP Morgan, the electrification of the transportation sector, provided the baseload power is reasonably green, is something I think we all ought to welcome. You know, whether or not they will be the, a sustained market leader. I wish I knew.
Question back there.
Hi, I'm Nick Jones. I'm with the University of London. My question is, where is the money going to come from for the Green Climate Fund? And in, say, 5 years' time, how much money could it realistically be implementing? Thank you.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's the, I don't know how many billion dollar question, but that's the question, right? And so the GCF has just been emboldened to go out and raise capital to get started. And I think they have sort of modest short-term goals to get going. And I don't want to put a dollar figure on what that looks like over the short term. But there will be a process, a UN-led process to, at a very sort of high level, heads of state level, if not finance minister level, to get pledges. Korea, which has a vested interest in getting things moving, has already made an initial $40 million pledge just to get some administrative things moving. And I think over the next year, you will see pledges moving forward. I think the challenges for governments, if you just look here in the United States, as an example, is where does the money come from an appropriations perspective? Does it get shifted from traditional appropriations? Is it new and additional money? Is it, do you look at sunsetting other climate activities or transferring money? It's those sorts of discussions that have to occur in capitals around the world. Do you look at alternative ways of raising capital from, new sources? There's a whole host of ways you could go about doing this. I think there's also a question of, can the GCF have the flexibility to raise capital outside of traditional, public money? Can it somehow partner with private sector capital in innovative ways to raise money that way, or work with, philanthropic money? I mean, I think those sorts of issues might be on the table as well. I think we're still need to figure out all that.
And, figuring out ways to leverage private money is something that a lot of state green banks in the U.S. are now trying to do. And I think that there has been a realization throughout developed economies that being a direct financier or direct lender is probably not the wisest use of scarce public dollars because of the scale necessary to affect this transition. So hopefully what we'll see are structures that rely on credit enhancement, loan loss reserves, things that are going to bail in private capital to achieve these mitigation ends.
Mr. Hong, back there.
Could you ask any one of them, any similar thing going on in China? I'm done. So I have to...
Similar thing as in what?
This green bond, the thing, environmental thing?
I think this Green Climate Fund is international, right? It's a multilateral entity with pledges from all governments across the board. Do you know anything particular of the Chinese governments?
Well, I mean, I think China's actively involved in the UN process and certainly is looking at the GCF and other opportunities as well.
But there's a Chinese member of the board, I believe, isn't there?
The way, as you may know, why I bring up the China issue is we get this polluting particles flying over the Yellow Sea now, not only Korea, it comes to the west coast of the United States. So in terms of a global point of view, and a small country like Korea can do it the best, but unless a big guy over there really comes serious about this thing, then I don't know how effective or cost-effective it is going to be.
Well, let me be clear, sir. The fund itself is housed in Songdo in Korea, but the investments are intended to be much more internationally developing country oriented than just, they're not supposed to, intended to be like focused on Korea themselves. They're supposed to be much more geographically diverse than that and to address a much broader set of greenhouse gas emissions or adaptation activities globally than that.
You know, the Chinese Banking Regulatory Commission has promulgated green banking guidelines that are intended to, I don't know if impose is the right word, but to incorporate environmental priorities into the credit allocation process. I think it's early days yet to see how and whether that will be an effective way to direct more capital to environmentally improving activities. I think, you know, it's not clear. There was an article in the FT today, interestingly, regarding a Chinese investment vehicle that essentially repackaged loans from a Chinese coal company, and that has gone into distress. It's not clear what the ultimate resolution of this investment vehicle is going to be. But I bring it up because everybody here knows the big air pollution problems that China is having. But to the extent that that specific coal companies, that the loans that it took out are impaired because of government environmental policy, the decision to improve the air and therefore burn less coal, that's an interesting and I think probably unwelcome realization. And so I think there are a lot of very complicated national environmental regulatory questions that the GCF is going to have to deal with when it looks at a specific country and a specific project. So, which kind of goes back to my point about how long it's going to take to have an effect. These are really complicated issues. And I think that deliberation is probably the better part of valor here.
Their goal is 2020, right? Is that a realistic goal given what Granville's just said?
Well, I mean, the goal is a money goal, right? But that's not a, you know, there's, you can, you, it's really a push-pull issue, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can set targets for developed countries to put money towards developing countries towards climate finance, but you, and you can fulfill those targets, but you also need to work in partnership and build programs and policies in developing countries and here at home that set policy certainty for the long term that you're going to reduce emissions and that takes a lot of work, and that's the harder part in my view. I mean the money can come. It's not easy to shake it out of governments. I don't want to dismiss that, but the money can come, particularly the private capital can come, but you really need to get those policies and policy certainty in place, and that takes a lot of work too. I think that's the point Granville's trying to make at the end of the day here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the experience of the European Union's emission trading scheme, you know, we had certainty, right? You know, they put a carbon price in place. and the carbon price was too low. And so it didn't really materially change the carbon intensity of the European economy. There are a lot of things going on in the background, but it's an example of there's a policy. It was clear. They didn't really monkey around with it a little bit, but by and large, it was consistent over a 5-7 year period, and it didn't really move the needle. So it wasn't really about money. You know, I mean, European utilities are, you know, they could raise money. And how you get the policy right, I think, is a more determining feature than whether or not the capital is available, because the capital is available.
Divya, did you have a question?
Hi, sorry, a second question from Divya at Trucost. I was curious, as countries contribute to the GCF and sort of intermediaries in the form of banks are either underwriting or also getting involved with the transformative projects that it seeks to implement, does it have knock-on effects on the other sorts of financial aid given by those countries or lending being done by those banking institutions? So, for example, if you're investing in a new transportation sector in a country, are you then lessening your investment in other kinds of automobile companies or that sector? Is there some sort of portfolio balancing that happens, or do you see that kind of tension happening?
Yeah, you know, I don't do sovereign risk, so I wouldn't think so. I mean, you know, obviously you can't go from zero to infinity, but you know, this will be, you know, in an environment, in a context of you know, expanding economic growth, you know, it's easier to make decisions. You know, there's so many factors that go into, you know, what your risk appetite is. I think it's hard to answer the question without, you know, a specific transaction or portfolio sitting in front of you.
Question over here.
Hi, my name's Andrew Friedman. I'm an advisor at the Palau Mission here in New York. Thank you both for providing your expertise today. My question is about small island states and least developed countries. I'm sure this is something that the board has probably been wrestling with behind the scenes, but these are some countries that are obviously at greatest risk, facing the effects of climate change. At the same time, they're in the weakest position to leverage capital to mitigate its effects. And really, in these countries, when we're talking about mitigation, we're talking not about leveraging opportunities, but avoiding catastrophe. So my question is, even at its early stages, what sort of options is the fund exploring for creatively addressing these mitigation issues at the very high end risk of the climate change spectrum?
Well, I actually would consider it more of an adaptation issue than a mitigation issue. You know, when you're talking about small island states and the climate risks that are being faced, I mean, yeah, some of it could be about mitigation and resilient power systems and that sort of stuff, but a lot of it's about just being able to absorb the blows of inevitable extreme weather events and that sort of thing. And when I'm not in the deliberations of the board, so I can't speak exactly to that, but I know that the direction that's coming out of the UN process and the dialogue I hear around the GCF and in the UN negotiations, certainly the small island states are being heard in those discussions when it comes to funding and adaptation and some, you know, portion of the money, you know, being directed towards those countries. And, you know, I know it's a problem, and I know the voice being heard is a real challenge, and I share your concern, and so, you know, I think it's a real issue, but I think it's certainly on the table, but you know, it's a problem. But I mean, I can say when I was over in Songdo, it was a consistent drumbeat of that issue being brought up from a lot of different stakeholders.
One more question.
Hi. I had a point of clarification first, which is the Green Climate Fund, are we talking about grants or loans? And are we talking about exclusively to the private sector or to exclusively to the public or to the private sector as well? And following on from that, I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the kind of financial approaches you're talking about, which are the most promising options for leveraging in private capital for a given amount of funding. What are the best kind of approaches that the GCF can be considering?
Well, I'll take the first part of that, and maybe I'll have ask Granville to chime in on the second. I mean, I think the fund is going to have a strong public element, which is about concessional loans and grants primarily, and that could be direct aid, traditional aid types of projects, generally about public money, and that could go out in a number of different ways. But I would think about it as traditional, grants and concessional finance, or concessional loans is probably a better way to put it. And then it's going to have a private sector window. And that's more about, the types of issues we've been talking about here in this conversation. And the mechanisms and tools of that private sector window of the GCF remain to be fully identified, and I think will become more into focus over the next 6 months to a year. So that's generally how it's going to be worked out. But that's the general structure of it at this point.
It really depends on what we're going to try to finance. To the extent that the GCF is going to look at specific projects and attempt to finance specific projects, as I said earlier, J.P. Morgan doesn't do a tremendous amount of project finance. But if that is the approach, the GCF is going to want to arrive at structures that can de-risk the transaction. So is there a way for the GCF to provide guarantees around project risk? Is there a way for the GCF to take first loss in order to incent private capital to come in? If the GCF is taking a broader corporate finance approach, whether or not the GCF could partner with another multilateral agency for some sort, or a financing government for some kind of guarantees, that would of course make private sector capital more available. But I think it's going to depend in what John sort of started out with. What is the business plan for the GCF? And once we understand that, then we can get to some of these other very important questions about how to make the best use of the limited capital that they're going to have.
I think that's all the time we have for Q&A. Our speakers will be here for a few minutes if you'd like to ask them some questions or have any comments for them. Please join me in thanking both of them for an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
We have a lot of you who are not members in the audience here from, UN entities and World Bank and so forth. We'd really encourage you to join us as members. If you're interested in business and politics, please join us back on February 10th. We have Victor Cha talking about winter games from Sochi to Pyeongchang. And after that, on February 20th, we'll be talking about startups and entrepreneurship and innovation in Korea. So please join us back. Thank you all for coming today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.